This podcast is being recorded on the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging, and acknowledge their ongoing connection to land, waters, and culture. Genocide and colonization are ongoing processes that continue to this day. Sovereignty was never ceded. This always was, and always will be, Aboriginal land.
It's time for Men and the Dunce. Men and the Dunce.
Hey everyone, welcome back to episode 3 of the unfortunately titled series Noon and the Dunce, where I explain Marxist theory to Zach in the form of confusing memes. This week, this episode is Denk Exploitation, episode 3, and this is the third of 4 episodes that we're going to be doing. So last time we looked at how Marx used the labor theory of value to explain how commodities get prices. Do you remember that, Zach?
Yeah, vaguely. I feel like the main gist of it was like the value that products or commodities have is actually something that is more like societally decided, mm-hmm. as opposed to decided by the value of the labor that goes into their production.
Yes. And the way that Marx talked about that, there were two different types of value. There's use value, which is what you actually use a thing for, and the exchange value, which is the price. And he argued that labor creates both of those, but in different ways, whatever. So last week we were looking at how value is created by labor. And this week we're going to talk about where that value goes. And the answer, somewhat unsurprisingly, is that capitalists take it for themselves. So Zach, could you read to the audience our first meme for this episode?
Okay, it's one of those memes that says, I keep losing these things. And it's got a picture of keys, a picture of a wallet, a picture of a remote control, and then the last frame is a picture that says, my surplus labor value under the capitalist mode of production. I can't find it, it's all gone.
Yeah,
I've checked all
right.
My pockets.
So I'm a big coffee drinker, and so I'm going to use a coffee example in this. So I buy a soy cappuccino, which you're all welcome to make fun of me for, and it costs like $4 or $4.50 at different cafes. And at my local cafe, I actually think the staff are paid there pretty well, like above the minimum wage, which is phenomenal for baristas. But those baristas make, say, like 30 coffees an hour. And that means that the barista pays for their own wages within 20 minutes of each hour. Right, with just the coffee that they make. Now, obviously, there's other costs going on. There's like overheads and there's beans and there's lighting and whatever. But you take my general point that if baristas were paid the full value of the coffee that they produce, the profits for the business would like completely disappear. And when I say completely disappear, I mean literally completely disappear. Because this is one of Marx's most fundamental points, which is that profit in capitalism, as well as nearly all other arrangements, comes basically exclusively from one source, which is paying workers less than the value they create. And this is called the appropriation of surplus labor value. That's the like dry Marxist term. And it's very obvious in the example with the barista, where we as like non-accountants can like look at the budget sort of roughly and be like, yeah, that's how much coffee costs, that's how much they're paid. And so we can see that no cafe could operate if they paid the barista the full value of the coffees that that person makes. But it's not only true of cafes, it's true of all other companies, and indeed that all previous existing societies, including our current capitalist one. And Marx says that throughout all of history, society has been arranged around one ruling class, and they're the ones that get to appropriate the value created by the other classes. And so, for example, in ancient Egypt, the pharaohs and the other nobility or whatever were the ruling class, and they owned slaves, and the slaves produced value by working, and the nobles appropriated that value and used it to build like pyramids and have feasts and stuff. And next week, we're going to talk a bit more about the different modes of production, which is like the different systems where there were different ruling classes and so on. But anyway, so in the modern world, Marx identifies two main classes. Zach, do you know what they are?
I'm going to go with... Mm-hmm. What is the bourgeoisie and the proletariat?
Very nice. Very good. Now, if you were on
I took
some
modern history
kind of
in
like,
year 10.
Nice, nice. If you were on a meme theory podcast and you were forced to guess the like textbook definitions of these classes, what would you say they are?
Well, I've had a little bit of a cheat sheet because I definitely... like, I mean, it's over a year ago now. Mm-hmm. And I think actually it was the first episode of Ozpol Shitposting that we ever recorded, and we ended up cutting this section. But
basically,
our original concept for the podcast was it was going to be half current affairs and then half you talking about Marxism.
Right.
And then we just sort of dropped the Marxism.
Which
but
is probably
I'm pretty
a good
sure
in
that first one, yeah. Yeah, we're getting it all in now.
Yep.
And I'm pretty sure that the thing you talked about in that first test episode was the way that people incorrectly characterize those classes.
Mm-hmm.
So let me see if I can remember.
Cool.
Hopefully I get it wrong so you can explain it to me.
Yeah.
So I'm pretty sure that the difference is that the proletariat basically make money and survive by working, and the bourgeoisie make money by having wealth and and like having that wealth invested and getting returns on that investment.
Yeah, that's very good, actually. So I'm not actually... I decided not to talk about what capital means in the series very much, but that's basically right. Bourgeoisie own capital, or the means of production, which is basically like the equipment and like the... When Marx was writing, it was much easier because it was like everyone was working in factories that made shoes or whatever, and the bourgeoisie owned the factory
coats.
And all of the coats. Exactly. Thank you. Yes, that's much more Marxist. The coat factory was owned by one guy, and he had bought all of the machines, and he bought all of the wool or whatever, and then he just hired workers to come in and operate those machines. So
what you're saying, there's one guy who has like a whole lot of vision and enterprise
go get
him
really
spirit.
Hard. Yep.
Yeah, exactly. And then he gets a bunch of slobs to just basically fart out essentially worthless labor, and he gets rewarded for his hard work.
Exactly.
That's what you're saying. Yep. Okay, cool. Yeah, no, I got it.
All right, so again, just to do that really succinctly, the bourgeoisie own the means of production, and the proletariat sell their labor power for wages. Those are the definitions of those two classes. And so the bourgeoisie hires the proletariat to operate the means of production. But the way that it works under capitalism is that the products of this process are owned by the bourgeoisie, or the owner of the business. So when the coffee gets sold at the cafe, the money goes to the owner rather than the labor, right? Because the products are owned by the business or the investor or the capitalist or however you want to frame that, not by the worker. And so the difference between how much value the worker creates and how much they get paid is called the surplus labor value. And it's this discrepancy between value created and wages paid that creates all profits in capitalism. And this relationship is called wage labor or wage slavery, depending on how edgy you want to be. So the bourgeoisie own the means of production, buy the labor power from the proletariat, and the bourgeoisie appropriate surplus labor value from the proletariat by paying them less than they create. The question I really want to kind of drill down on here is, how do they get away with it? So, Zach, could you read us our next meme?
I will. Allow me to scroll down. So we've got a slaps top of meme.
Uh-huh.
So we've got a caricature of a capitalist standing next to
a
potential car buyer, a capitalist pig. Is it an Animal Farm pig? Potentially. No, that's communism. Never mind.
No, this is like a snouts in the trough corrupt pig.
Yeah. Standing next to a car and he's telling his prospective buyer, slaps commodity. This bad boy can fit so many surplus value in him.
Glad you like that one. Yeah.
Sorry, I feel like I did a bad job of describing that.
I think everyone
that's all right.
Knows the format.
They'll
of
They'll probably
the
get it. They know the meme.
Yeah.
Slaps roof of bad boy. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so last episode we were talking about commodity fetishism, and that's when we as individuals think that commodities have characteristics inherent in them that are actually not inherent but socially construed, right? So there's this, quote, spectral objectivity of value. Sorry to use all of the jargon, but I fucking love jargon. So
it's true, he does.
The spectral objectivity of value means that we feel like a coffee is actually worth the $4 or whatever that we pay, rather than feeling like we're paying for the labor that was performed to create that coffee, right? And I know that seems small, but it's an important issue because, as I've stressed repeatedly over the last couple of episodes, Marx was writing a critique of economics, not just a contribution to it. And the fundamental critique was that Marx thought that these categories and like fundamental concepts like exchange value and price and wage slavery, these like basic aspects of our economy, we're not always like this, and that things that appear to be facts of nature, like commodities having a value attached to them, actually social relations. And
you're making it up. It's all fake. It's all bullshit. Your world is lies. Can't you people see? I'm pretty sure that's the opening paragraph of the Communist Manifesto.
It's surprisingly close, yeah. but Marx argued that commodity fetishism is actually a really fundamental component of the way that the bourgeoisie hide their exploitation of the proletariat. Because when you attach that value to the object rather than to the laborer, it makes the laborer seem replaceable while the commodities and the production processes are not, right? So we've got this coat factory and the machines and the materials and the like process are the really important bit about that factory, right? The factory is like a real solid thing, whatever. These schlubs, as you put it, who come in and actually do all of the work to make the shoes, they're like replaceable, unskilled labor, fuck them. They're just there to like twiddle the machines, right? And so by...
Is slob an anglicization of schlub?
That's a good question. I'll look it up for next
week. Put a pin in that.
Yeah. So by this commodity fetishism, it makes it so much easier to hide the fact that it's the laborers that are making the value rather than the bourgeoisie. And by exchanging commodities rather than other sorts of goods, like without exchange value, it hides the appropriation of surplus value. And the belief that this exploitation of wage labor is like normal part of human history or whatever also comes from the way that social relations are misrepresented as objective fact. And that's why if you have a shitty uncle and you tell him you're a socialist, he'll laugh and tell you that you'll grow up sometime. Because he has bought in completely to this idea that the wage labor relationship is the only way to organize an economy. And that's just how reality is, mate. So get over it and grow up and get a job. Yeah, and so I think that might be a good note to end on, growing up and getting a job for this week. But yeah, I think for this episode, I just wanted to, yeah, look at how what we talked about last week, the commodity fetishism, allows the exploitation of the workers to go on while everyone thinks that it's like a completely normal and socially acceptable process. So
yeah, I think it's a good illustration of why understanding Marxist theory and, I guess, economic and social theory in general is important, because it's about understanding, like, if you can kind of peel apart the layers and understand exactly how the ideology that you have been taught since birth is kind of shielding you from investigating, like, beneath the surface of the system.
Yeah, absolutely.
Then, like, I think that's a vital part. Because, look, personally, and part of the reason why I've never attempted to read Marx, aside from the fact that I know that I wouldn't be able to, just like, in a literal sense, is that, yeah, I do, when I see a lot of conversation around this stuff happening, it seems super specific, very inside baseball, and honestly not super applicable to my life or the lives of the people around me.
Yep.
But there is some super critical stuff in there that is really important to understand in order to properly critique capitalism. So, you know, I think it's, that's why I've always appreciated the way that you absorb all the silly bullshit, pull out the little nuggets, and then regurgitate them for me. That was a bit of a visceral analogy, but
no, I think that's totally my point. Right. Yeah, yeah. And I think this happened to me a lot more before I started reading Marx, but it happens to everyone, including good principled Marxists, is that like we fall into very shallow critiques of capitalism. And I mean, stuff like what we talk about every week on the show is a good example of that, about the government screwing welfare recipients and so on. And like, yes, those are important decisions that are being made now that we can change to improve people's lives. But the superficial, they're superficial, and that they don't question any of the like social relations that exploitation is built upon, or any of the like, yeah, these fundamental components of wage slavery and so on. And yeah, I think that it's important that when we do push for reforms, we're also taking note of the way that they reinforce the like social power of the ruling class. And by being aware of this kind of like theoretical underpinning, I think it helps me just like hold that in mind when I'm critiquing policy from the Labour Party or whoever, who's never going to challenge these kind of fundamental things. But
Yeah. Mm. We need to do both. You need to tackle the immediate material conditions that are making people's lives hell.
Absolutely.
But you also need to hold, as you say, like a vision of something, an alternative system that will naturally produce these positive results that we're going for, as opposed to having to retrofit them to a system specifically designed to, with the opposite effect in mind. I don't know if that sentence made sense, but maybe you get me.
All right, cool. I think that's us for the week. Dank exploitation, done. Next week, dank history. We'll catch you then.
All right, cool. Take it easy, everybody. We'll see you in a couple days and then a few days after that.
Bye. Bye.